Hello, Freedom Nation. It's Jeff here once again with the Freedom Nation podcast. On today's show, I've got Moira Mills. She is has been traditionally unschooled, as she puts it. So that should make you interested to begin with. But what she really does is she works with folks that are trying to go from the public school system to homeschooling and understanding how to make that fit in. And I promise you, for those of you that are busy professionals and for those of you that are busy entrepreneurs who go, there's no way I can do this because I can't spend 8 hours a day. Well, she's going to show you how to do it the right way. So stay tuned and we'll be right back in just 1 second.
Welcome to the Freedom Nation Podcast with Jeff Kickle. On this show, Jeff shares his expertise in financial and retirement planning from a different perspective. Planning for your Freedom Day, which is the first day that you wake up and have enough income or assets and do not have to go to work that day. Learn how to calculate what you need, how to generate income sources, and listen to interviews from others who've done it themselves. Get ready to experience your own Freedom Day.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. Moira, welcome on, my friend.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you on because I want to break some myths today about the one, how great the traditional schooling system is, two, that busy people can actually homeschool their children, and three, we need to fix people's brains long beforehand so that I don't have to do the fixing on the back end side, getting them to their Freedom Day. So that said, why don't you tell us your story? How did you get to where you are today?
Yes. So I was born and raised in rural Alaska on a homestead.
Okay.
So we had lots of animals. I was outside a lot in nature. Lots of snow. Yes. Yes. And I was unschooled. So essentially that means I never went to school, not even what you would generally see in homeschool. Like we did not have books with subjects. I didn't do testing. It really was self-led. So that's kind of what the definition of unschooling is that it's self-led, child-led, interest-led. There's lots of different terms for it. But essentially it's coming from this belief that we are all designed to want to learn things. Mm-hmm. And when we follow that path, that's going to be a better outcome overall than when we dictate it from the outside and make everyone learn everything exactly the same way at the same time. And then, you know, use tests to determine how much they've learned and where they fall in that.
Sure.
So I had that as my upbringing. I got into my 20s and I decided that I was going to go become normal. So I lived between, New York and California.
Okay.
And I tried to fit myself into this box of what people expected, but then things would happen and I would realize like I have a very different opinion on this. I have a very different perspective on this. And I hid it a lot in my 20s. And I just kind of observed what was happening around me and a very different world in California and New York. And then when I decided to have kids, I was in my early 30s. And that's when I said, okay, well, where are we at with childhood? Mm-hmm. I hadn't been around kids for, you know, 10, 15 years. And so I wanted to know what was happening in education. And then I started thinking, well, what's the world that we're passing the next generation on to? Mm-hmm. And I went, oh, no. There's another way. And, you know, the way that we're doing it can work for some people. Okay. Mm-hmm. But there's a whole other way. And I have this experience that I would like to share and help people. And then I started running into more and more people that wanted to question the system, but had grown up in it.
Yeah.
And that transition of starting to question can be a really lonely place, I think. Mm-hmm. And so recognizing kind of where that support was needed, and I guess the rest is history.
That's the rest is history, yeah.
10 years ago.
So, you know, let's give the framework for a typical, you know, homeschool day or unschooled, whatever you want to put it. So they get up at, you know, 6 o'clock in the morning and they're in their desks by 8 o'clock and they're there, you know, just different subjects for the next 6-7 hours. And then, you know, then they get out and they go play with their friends and all that. So that's homeschooling, right?
Oh, goodness. I would have had a miserable childhood if that was the case. So I like to use the example of as an adult, what what's our day like? Something fascinates me. Granted, we didn't have, you know, YouTube and TikTok and all of these things back then. But when something, I find something fascinating, I go research it. And nobody is standing over my shoulder telling me to go learn about that thing. Mm-hmm. Nobody's reminding me. And then I think back at infancy, like we do not have to tell toddlers to practice learning the language. Mm-hmm. We don't have to remind toddlers to learn how to walk. Like if you're a parent, you know, you can't prevent that from happening. You can't like stop them, that they just have this internal drive. And to think of how much learning happens in those first like 3 to 5 years is massive. So then why do we shift that thinking into we need to dictate it from the outside, so regimented? So a day in the life looks very different day to day, and it depends on what kind of the current project is of the day. There's a lot of work involved still, but it's not a predictable, regimented kind of same thing every day.
I go to history class between 9 and 10 o'clock and all that. And it may not, I'm assuming, and I've never homeschooled anybody. I'm assuming that it might not even be that, hey, we talk about history today. We might be working on something different, or the next day might be an entire history project day where you're focusing on, you know, learning about the Civil War or something like that.
Absolutely. So we rode school full time, which means we're constantly traveling. Okay. So when we first left the kind of New England area and headed south, we went, one of our first stops was Gettysburg. Okay. So we stayed in Gettysburg for 3 nights, I think. Mm-hmm. So there were 3 days of learning some American history.
Yep.
You know, nothing else in those days. It was all about history. We were there on the earth that was happening.
I remember watching. So I'm a history buff. So I remember watching Gettysburg and, you know, Gods and Generals and all those things.
Yep.
It wasn't until I actually was there. You know, like I come from Texas, so, you know, I have a huge heart for any of the soldiers that fought there. And, you know, I knew that they fought towards Little Round Top and all that stuff. It wasn't until I stood on the ground on top of Little Round Top and looked down onto the I think it's the needles or whatever they call it, the rocks that are down there that the Texans fought through. That was when all of a sudden it came alive to me. And I was, you know, in my 40s at that time. So
yes. And nobody told you to go do that. It wasn't like, this is your assignment this week, go learn this. And then we're going to test you on it. And then we're going to score you on how much you learned.
Yeah. No. Same thing. You know, we went over to, I'm a World War II history buff and, you know, love the Band of Brothers series and all that.
Yep.
And lucked out when we were over in Normandy, we hooked up with a tour that, you know, it was 2-day tour. So, I mean, my wife is not a huge history buff, but she's become one.
Yeah.
She was like, this is my gift to you. These guys apparently know a lot about Band of Brothers. Well, they had actually been the first tour group that took the Band of Brothers guys back to Normandy.
So they were
not only were they taking them around, but they're getting all these stories from these guys and they're all historians and all this. So, you know, I mean, it was like the Band of Brothers tour on steroids. But, you know, once again, I'm a paratrooper. I knew about the paratroopers and where they were and everything else. But until you're on the ground and you understand how all that stuff links together. Yeah. I mean, I can imagine for kids, it just massively, you know, they're a big sponge as it is, but massively helps them understand how all this fits together.
Yes, exactly. And that is at the core how we work. And so we were in Jacksonville, Florida, and he wanted to learn surfing. So I found a homeschool dad that knew surfing. I have to say I was thrilled he was interested in surfing versus snowboarding. I'm not a snow person so much.
I was going to say, after all those years in Alaska, I can imagine Jacksonville sounded a heck of a lot better.
Oh, it's fantastic. So, you know, I have my fears around sharks.
Sure.
He doesn't have any of that fear. It was great. This guy was fantastic with him. We could do classes. Also, the amazing thing is we could do these one-on-ones after the kids had all went back to school. So okay. The beaches are quieter. It was fantastic. So he got to learn. So something like surfing, you're uh-huh. learning, you know, you can learn a lot of different things. Math, for example, uh-huh. like how your body is on the board, how you get yourself up, that is math. Uh-huh. So being able to change kind of the view of what math needs to look like.
Yeah.
That's like a real world. You're learning how your body is in space mm-hmm. and how you're balancing and how the waves come in and hit the shore. And all of that stuff is a really embodied experience of something that sure you could get out of a textbook, but I think it's so much more. Wow,
but I mean,
impactful.
You think of what you could combine into that one lesson.
Yes.
Math, physics, even biology, understanding what's in the water and everything else around there and why you should be scared of sharks.
and riptides. Like,
and riptides.
I have this fear of riptides that, you know, made me very nervous. And, you know, he got to learn all about that, too.
Yeah. But, I mean, and then I'm assuming you're basically able to kind of sit back and, okay, let me quiz you a little bit on this. Let me, you know, let's understand how we can apply these lessons to, you know, to actual math and physics and everything else. So that's awesome.
Yeah. It's,
you know,
it's a lot of fun, really.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost like too much fun. You're doing that. So let me play devil's advocate. Okay. Mm-hmm. So now you've unschooled your child. They don't have the structure. How are they ever going to get a job?
Oh, such a great question, because I don't think we need to be raising a generation of employees in a general sense.
Yeah.
We need to be raising a generation of kids. We have a lot of issues in our world, and the foundation of being an entrepreneur is recognizing something that you see as a problem that you have a solution for, creating that solution and bringing it into the world. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, is what we need to be focusing on with our kids, is where is their passion in. And when I say that, I don't mean just like doing things that feel fun all the time. Mm-hmm. That's not what this is about at all. And I think that that's a really important distinction to make. But it's about finding things that we're connected with, why we would even want to impact the world that way, right? So it could, I mean, there's millions of different variations of this, but we can, if we take like the surfing example, like maybe that leads into, you know, one being recognizing that we have an impact on the environment around us and we want to keep it clean, not because we've been told that we're supposed to, you know, recycle or do this or do that, and that's how we're going to affect it, but that we have an actual impact. We're in the water, we're seeing what's happening in the water around us, and maybe that means that you move on into, you know, addressing some issue that you see in that experience. So there's a lot of work that comes along with it, but it's not a predetermined endpoint that you're going for. You're letting it unfold organically and seeing where it leads. That makes sense. It's like from the inside out.
Well, versus, I mean, I could see so many, you know, when you start to think of the rays that come off of that, I mean, you could very well go, hey, you know, I have a love for the environment, but I understand that we need to create energy in that environment. I'm going to become a petroleum engineer so that I can help ensure that we don't ruin the environment, you know, and do this stuff the right way. And maybe there's better ways that we can do it and all that stuff. So
I mean,
there's so many different ways. You're not hemming your child into, well, this is the only way.
Yes.
And this is the only way you're ever going to learn and everything else. So how do you, I guess the best way to explain it is, how do you standardize that knowledge to make sure that they have an equal to their peers, you know, once they graduate effectively?
So I would say that that's one of the biggest things that we need to really rethink on a very fundamental level, because when we are comparing and trying to standardize it, I think what we're destroying in that process is the very gold that is possible. Yeah. So as soon as we start trying to create it that way, that's when we get off track really very quickly. And so there's all this competition, right? And it starts in infancy. Mm. This is a big wake-up call for me because, so I have, my background is as a rolfer, which is, for people that don't know, it's a form of body work where I work with the fascia and the connective tissue. So essentially what that means is the structure of the body, the tendons, the ligaments. I worked a lot with athletes that would get injuries. Mm. And there's a lot of, I got myself a little off track with that. I was heading down a path. And that was very important, but give me a second.
Yeah.
Can you ask me the question again, please?
Well, just how do we make sure that they're, the things are somewhat standardized, you know, because I mean, there's a certain level of expectation that, okay, yes, you have graduated high school, you have X layer of knowledge, or you've got X amount of knowledge now. That's
right.
Okay. If you know anything about the education system, that's not necessarily true. But,
well, it's not. And there was an article I've tried to find, and there's many kind of studies on this at this point, but there was an article in a New York newspaper a few years ago, and it talked about the percentage of graduating high schoolers that mm-hmm. were not capable of being able to fill out a basic job application. Like, so the standards are insanely low mm-hmm. when we talk about that. And so that's what I was going to say. So we're constantly rating and ranking, right?
Yeah.
So when a baby's born, we're measuring them. We are checking at how, you know, their percentile. We're putting them there in the 7th percentile, the 90th percentile. And a big wake up call for me is that's not, those percentiles are not based on a healthy objective. It's just on an average of the kids that are born at that time. So sure. You're just rating your kids against the other kids that are being born at that time. I don't care about those measurements. Hmm. I care, is this person in front of me healthy? Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter where they fall, right?
Yeah.
So we get reading is a big thing for people, right? Mm-hmm. So there's this fixation too that has gotten more intense over the last 10-15 years, which now they want kids to be reading, like, you know, they know their letters by 3, be reading by 4. Mm-hmm. There's no research to show that that is beneficial later in life. And there's actually research that does show that it's more detrimental for the kids that are mm-hmm. learning to read much younger, that it's actually more detrimental later in their learning process than it is helpful, right? But we're not looking at that data. We're constantly pushing younger.
Mm-hmm.
I did not learn how to read until I was probably 11 or 12.
Wow.
I didn't need it, yeah. Right? My mom read to me a ton.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and people are horrified now when they hear that age. Mm-hmm. My mom read to me a ton. She read to me every night. She was reading like the Lord of the Rings trilogy when I was like 6 or 7.
Sure.
So there was a lot of, I was getting a lot. Dad would read the Bible a couple times a week. Like we had a lot of that. And it wasn't until I turned this age where I started thinking about what I wanted to do. And I wanted to be a veterinarian. Mm-hmm. So my sister joked, she's about 5 years older. She joked, she was like, I didn't think you were ever going to learn how to read. And then you went to reading like vet textbooks,
yeah,
essentially. Cause I was like, this is something that I want. Reading is
I'm
relevant
in, this.
In
I gotta
my
do
life
this.
Now. Yeah. And then I got on this bandwagon of, I loved Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew books.
Mm.
Like I loved them. I loved, and then there's an author, is it James Patterson? No, that's not the right name. But he wrote All Creatures Great and Small. He was vet in rural England.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, this is amazing. I think he really inspired me. I didn't want to be a vet for dogs and cats. I wanted large livestock.
Yeah.
So then I got into reading those. So I went from like not reading at all to being a voracious reader.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so now when I look back on it,
you saw a purpose for it in your life at that point. I need all this information. I've got to absorb this information as fast as possible.
Right. And so I really wanted to do that.
Mm.
And so we get so hung up on the ability to read, right?
Yeah.
But that, whether, I think a more important thing to focus on is, are we raising generations of kids that actually become readers and pick up a book, because what use is the skill at being able to read words on a page if we're not ever using it? If we don't pick up a book in adulthood and read it, what good really is that skill? And then also thinking of literacy as being, it's not, literacy is not just about being able to read words on a page. It's being able to understand and connect dots, and this, it's so much more than that, right? So
well, and I think it's the ability to analyze that data and pull out the important stuff. You know, I've said this, you know, I write business books. You know, most business books, I'm a voracious reader. There's maybe 20 to 30 pages in a 130 page book that are the basis of, you know, the base information that you need to move on. The rest of it's fluff that's in there basically just to fill out the book, because if you gave somebody a 30 page book, there's no way they're going to spend $12 to $15 on it. It's that ability to go in and grab that information out, or grasp, okay, this is the important stuff out of this one book that I can carry on and utilize that information. And, you know, every successful entrepreneur I know, and I interview on the show and everything else, I mean, when I ask the one question at the end, what's a good book? I mean, half of them are like, oh, but I've got this one. And then I've got this. No, one. Just give me one. It's all I need.
And that's so, so, so important. I want to raise a generation of children that become teens, become adults, pick up books and actually read them and understand them and have a, can have a conversation about them. If they don't learn how to read until they're 16, I don't care, really. But it all has to be based on, I have a very deep belief that we are designed to want to learn things. And when the time is right, we can learn things very easily. But society has determined that these things need to happen in this schedule that, honestly, it works for some people. Okay, there's a percentage that it can work for. But a mass majority of the population, the system's not working for you. I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with adults that had a miserable school experience. And like, this, it was awful, you know, if whatever, there's, you know, a million stories for a million people. But like, it's not working. And then the other thing, real quick, about the literacy rates. I think this is such an important thing to know. So we had a higher literacy rate before compulsory education. So before compulsory education laws, our country had a 98% literacy rate. Ever since compulsory education laws, we have not went above 93%. So
I think we're probably even lower than that, I would venture to say.
I mean, this number is from, I want to say, like the mid-90s. So I can't imagine where we're at.
The most recent, we saw the stats come out of the Department of Education. I mean, this is a big reason why they're like, okay, this is broken, let's stop, because we suck at this. I mean, the last study, I think it was 2024, 2023, like kids getting out of high school, only 40% of them could read at grade level. I mean, that's insane.
So if we connect that we're pushing it younger and younger, and there is more of a fixation on reading specifically being targeted and pulled out, but all we've done is declined, this is something that we really need to have a very deep conversation about.
We need to understand it better. We need to understand it better of how people absorb that. And, you know, it's not like you didn't talk to anybody or have conversations or thoughts or arguments with people prior to age 11 when you started to actually read. You did. You just used language in a different way. And it wasn't as important for you to sit down with a book and read at that point when you had somebody else that was reading with you at that point and hopefully helping you to understand what this means. Because if you hand the Lord of the Rings to a six-year-old and try and force them to read it, it's a pretty hefty book to read at that point. So let me ask this question of you, and I don't know where the answer is going to be, but where do you see the education world and AI intersecting?
Oh, this is such a fantastic, and part of it, we don't know.
Yeah.
Like, I think in some ways, like, we've got, like, there's lots of ideas. I think that AI is a fantastic tool. Mm-hmm. I think that I see this split where people either want to, like, really dig into it and use it for everything all the time. And then you see mm-hmm. there's a lot of people that are avoiding it completely.
Yeah.
I think it's a tool. Yes. It's a very powerful tool. We need to treat it like a tool, which means we really need to understand it. We cannot just we can't put our head in the sand when it comes to it. We are interacting with AI all the time at this point. You go Google something, AI, you go look for an airplane ticket, AI, you go into chat for, you know, some company's chatbot, it's AI. Like, we are surrounded by it. We cannot avoid it. I think it's an amazing tool. Mm-hmm. But I do think there needs to be a lot of education around it. I do not like how the current education system is wanting to just completely disregard it in many ways and penalize kids for using it. That's not the world they're growing up into. We need to look at what's the world going to look like in, I mean, goodness, I would say 50 years.
As fast as it's going, it's 10 years from now, it's going to be a whole different world than we live today.
Right. We cannot educate them for the life of today because, I mean, just the last 5 years, it is like my head hurts thinking about all the things that have changed. So, like, these kids, like, my son's going to be 10. So fast forward 10 years. Oh, my gosh. I can't even imagine where we're going to be. So I think that it's really powerful. I think that it really needs to be understood. Now, I will say I am a big advocate against technology in the younger years. I think it is so, so important for them to be outside in the dirt, interacting with people, humans, face to face. I think that that my son's age now, we're, you know, creeping into 10, I'm allowing a little more technology in. It's a very different question, though, I think, if we're talking about 5-year-olds or we're talking about 15-year-olds.
Sure.
I think it evolves a lot. Yeah, I mean, do not like seeing the tablets in 3-year-olds' hands at all.
Yes. Well, or my favorite is when you go to a restaurant and you've got mom, dad, and the kids, and they're all sitting there at the table, and all of them have got phones or tablets. Yeah. You know, and the kids have to be entertained nonstop. It's like, at the most, when I would go to when I grew up, it was like, okay, maybe I had something to color while I was there. That was something that, you know, entertained me or whatever while my parents were talking or whatever. But yeah, I think I'm with you. I think early on, they should not have no child needs a cell phone prior to, let's call it 16. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I agree.
At that point, you're kind of off on your own, or you're able to do your own stuff, and your car could break down or something like that. Yes, you do need it. You know, the argument that, well, you know, my child needs one in school just because, you know, if they get sick or whatever, there's a front office, there's a nurse that can make that phone call. They don't need to have a phone with them constantly. And
I think there's also a discussion here of how important boredom is.
Yeah.
Like, we really want to get rid of boredom in our kids' lives. And that's the last thing that they need. They need long, bored days of having nothing to do. Like, that's where creativity and imagination come into play. So if they are constantly entertained from the outside, they never have this opportunity.
They don't have to do it.
Is, right. And it's such a valuable space that they really need. But we've really gotten away from finding that at all acceptable.
Because it's the easy way. It's the easy way out. Just, throw a video on the TV, or, you know, then that babysits them, and we don't have to really interact with the kids at that point.
Well, yes. And I think that there's a really important point here of it's good to be, like, uncomfortable doesn't equal bad.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think that there's a lot of, like, we just want our kids to be happy and be comfortable and have what they want because we think that's what's going to create happiness. And that's not the case.
Yeah.
I mean, they have more access to this technology than ever before. And our depression rates are through the roof. Like, it's not true. And so being okay with not feeling okay is a really important thing that we have, like, banned to, like, the recesses of, like, we don't allow that to come into place. And it is such an important thing.
And, you know, I think this generation of parents, I'm sorry for saying this for those of you that are out there, but this generation of parents that, don't want their children to fail, that don't want their children to feel pain, that don't want their children to, you know, be bored or whatever. You know what? Just got to let them live and they've got to learn. Yeah. You know, I mean, I knew pretty much, my dad kind of pushed me down the road of becoming an engineer. And unfortunately, when I got to college, I realized there's no way in hell I could do that for a living. And, you know, I changed everything and really made an adjustment to my life. And, you know, God, thank the Lord for that, of being able to make that adjustment, because I've had a much, much more different life. I mean, it was the same thing going from working as a corporate employee for 20 years and then literally quitting my job and starting a business overnight. And, you know, it was very painful for 3 to 4 years of building those businesses up to where then they started to generate a revenue. And, you know, I haven't looked back since and sold a couple of them in that process. So, you've got to experience some pain. I mean, I love when I hear parents that, you know, the kids are like, well, I have to have a 2-bedroom apartment and, you know, we've got to have furniture and all this. And I'm like, dude, have you ever been past an electrical lot and they've got those big wooden things? That's a great table. I'm just saying, we had one of those in my apartment at college. It was awesome. You know, you couldn't destroy it. It was great and it was free. So perfect.
Yep.
And you can't live life without having that experience, I think. So let me ask you this question. My children do decide to go to college, or they do decide they want to do this, but they've homeschooled. How does that all fit in as far as being able to qualify to go to college and stuff like that?
So at this point, universities are searching out homeschool kids.
Interesting.
Because they want kids that want to learn. So that's a piece. There are, I didn't go the university route. I became a rolfer, so that's more like a trade school. So I can't speak from personal experience on that as much, but there are so many homeschoolers that go on to university. Mm. As a homeschool parent, you create the diploma for your kid. You put together the transcripts. Okay. So you walk away from this experience with everything that you need.
Okay.
And then you can go, you know, a lot of people I know choose to do the SATs or the GEDs. Mm. Those are, or they're, you know, there's a lot of different ways that people have done it, but it is not at all a barrier.
The funny thing is, so I own a co-working space and we installed into the place a Pearson View testing center. And one of the things we do is test for GEDs.
Oh, okay.
And I'm like, I've literally told my wife multiple times, I'm like, when we need to hire another employee, I'm specifically going to put in the ad, I'm really only looking for people with a GED. Because I'm like, they are the most polite. They are very, I mean, you can tell they're super freaking smart. Yes, there's the ones that, you know, kind of failed out of high school and then realized, oh crap, I've got to be able to get a job. So I need to get a GED. But the vast majority of the ones that we have come through the test center, and we get to interact with them a lot because they have to take 4 tests to get out. So we see them 4 times or sometimes more. And I'm like, they are sharp. I mean, they are so sharp. And I'm like, I would hire them in a heartbeat.
And they want to be there. A lot of times that's like an adult choice. They have decided this is relevant in my life right now. I'm going to go study. I'm going to go do it. Awesome. That's a fantastic.
Yeah, perfect. And, you know, then you get that standardized, okay, I have all this knowledge and I can go on to the next thing. And, you know, I think they did a cool thing here in Austin where the Austin Community College, what they ended up doing is they just basically said, anybody that gets a GED gets free tuition for the 2 years of Austin Community College. So we saw a pretty big jump in like people getting their GED so that they could get, you know, man, I can just go get a free education then after that. And I want to learn this stuff. And
And so many big companies now are getting rid of the requirement to have degrees. To have a degree.
Yeah.
So like, it's irrelevant in the world that we are moving into. The degrees yes, you need to go to university for certain things if you yep. want to be like a physician or you want to be, but right. I follow a woman. Oh my gosh, I can't remember the name of her TikTok, but she helps parents of teenagers figure out what careers they're going to get into that are not that typical model. And she was saying that only 7.7% of the jobs today require any really kind of university.
Yeah, really require. Yeah. If you're going to be a doctor, you've got to go to medical school. I'm sorry. It's just.
Right. If you want to be a lawyer, if you want to be a doctor, like there are a few things, but it is such a small percentage of the avenues that. But,
you know, the thing that makes me laugh is lawyer, perfect example of that. Mm-hmm. You didn't have to go to law school. Abraham Lincoln didn't go to law school. He went, you know, the way the law worked here in this country up until, I don't even know when it really changed. It was probably early 10s, you know, 1910s or whatever. Prior to that, you had basic, you know, you basic reading skills, and then you went to read the law, which was you went and partnered up with a, you know, a lawyer, a practicing lawyer. And the reason you went to read the law is because you actually went, that person typically had a law library, and you literally went and read through all the law books. And then once you read through all the law books, then, you know, then you practiced what you had learned and you became a practicing attorney. And then you did that same thing to help other people. You know, I was doing some research for a fiction book that I'm working on, and you know, the character that I have in there is a lawyer, you know, during the American Revolution. And I had it, you know, a character who's a lawyer, and I tied him to John Adams. Yep. And, you know, I started doing some research, and I'm like, well, did John Adams ever teach at a law school or anything like that? And he never taught at a law school, but he had a significant series of very well-known lawyers that worked with him, and he taught the law basically in his law office and was extraordinarily prominent. So I don't see the reason for law schools half the time, because they don't actually learn how to be lawyers. They go and study basically what reading the law used to be, and then they go to work for an attorney or for a firm, and that's where they actually learn how to go to court and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. See? So, yeah, doctor, totally different animal. You kind of got to go. Anything else? I mean, honestly, I don't see a lot of purpose, you know, and I see the education that's coming out of a lot of these schools, and it's just, okay, so I've had people that have worked for me that have had degrees, and I'm like, you are the dumbest human being I've ever met. You know, and not your fault. The system made you dumber at that point. And, you know, like I said, I'd hire a GED kid in a heartbeat, you know, a 19-year-old GED kid, I would hire in a heartbeat, because you worked hard to get there. You did the work to get that education, and you probably learned something, I'm guessing, along the way.
Right.
Now, maybe they may prove me wrong, but I'm just saying that.
I think that's pretty accurate. And I think and going to the lawyer thing too, so the teacher, this is a really important point too, is that teachers, the qualification to be a teacher, like back when we had the one room schoolhouse before this kind of monstrosity that we have now, the qualification was that you went through the education yourself. So it was generally like a young woman, and she went through it. So then she taught it. It really wasn't until, and I'm spacing on the year now. It wasn't until like much later that, and it really is thanks to Carnegie, who set up the teacher's training. Mm-hmm. Like there was a period of time where it was this shift into, now we need to teach teachers how to be teachers. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't about knowing the information, it was about becoming a teacher. And those schools, I think this is so important, those schools were called the normal schools.
Yeah.
So this is where teachers went to be trained how to be a teacher at the normal school. And there's a great quote that I cannot say off the top of my head. It's Woodrow Wilson had a quote, and it was basically saying, we want one class of people to have a liberal education, yes. and we want another class of people to have be the workers, basically.
Yes.
That's a much larger part. We want
one,
workers.
One of the most evil human beings that has walked on this earth.
Oh, my goodness. And they're very upfront about saying it. He was very clear. We want two classes of people.
Without a doubt. Yeah, with no conscience or anything about it. It was like, we need a certain amount of people that can think, and we need a whole bunch of people that can't think that'll just work. You know, right. and we need to design schools around that. Yeah, don't get me going, because I anytime I hear people like, oh, he was the greatest, but no, he was not.
No.
He was an evil man, evil man. Wildly racist, by the way.
Yes.
So last question for you.
Yeah.
I kind of did a U there. I'm like, okay, I had the question in my head and then it went. Last question. If somebody, and this is where I was going, if somebody doesn't have the ability to travel on the road and teach and everything else, I am a busy, active entrepreneur. I'm a busy professional. I don't have a spouse that can take, that can work from home or whatever. How do I do this?
The number one thing is for a million people, there's a million different ways to do this. So there's not a one size fits all. But the process that I think is fundamental to being able to get there for yourself is the process of de-schooling. And it really is like a detox. Okay. So if you've ever done any kind of like a food detox where you've had something going on in your body and you decide to cut out gluten and dairy, or big ones for people, let's cut it out and let's see how my system works, right? After that detox, foods will taste different. I remember when I first did a sugar detox and I went from hating dark chocolate to loving it. Mm-hmm. And after a couple months of not having sugar in my system, that dark chocolate tasted really good in a way that it tasted terrible before. Mm-hmm. So that detox process of our thinking and what education needs to look like and what learning needs to look like, we really need to spend sometimes a few months to really detox that to see what's possible. But I will say that it does not matter the kind of the situation. There's always a way to homeschool. Sometimes it means, cutting out certain things that we're used to. Sometimes it's not necessarily all comfortable, but it is possible. If you reach a point where this is the decision that you want to make, it is absolutely possible for everyone to do it. I believe that wholeheartedly. There's not a one size kind of fits all for everyone.
Yeah. And I mean, you got to figure out your situation, maybe arrange a different, is there a hybrid version? Maybe where they go to school and also are homeschooled.
So there's a lot of things popping up. Like, I think they're calling them micro schools. Basically, it's a community of families that get together.
Yeah.
Maybe there's one father that's an engineer and can teach something.
Makes sense, yeah.
Or a mother that's does baking bread with the kids or something. And you can just get together with your local community and then you can support each other in that process, which is like going back to more that one room schoolhouse mentality, which is, this is our community. How do we support our community? Mm-hmm. And not expecting the government to create that infrastructure for us. That's, I think.
Well, I mean, you basically could set up your own one room and maybe you find a retired teacher or somebody like that can come in and be the facilitator, so to speak. Of, they don't have to be the expert at everything, but they can bring, be the one that coordinates a lot of that type of stuff. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think that you're starting to see a lot of those different possibilities crop up all over the country. So that's fantastic. And there's, many different variations. But generally, I think this also comes back to needing to make real world face-to-face connections with the people in our community. And for us, our community is constantly changing because we're moving into different places. But so it can look very different. There are thousands of families now doing what's called road schooling or world schooling. So they're constantly traveling all over the world. There's thousands of other families to connect with that are
the guy, the surfer guy. He was another dad.
Yes.
That's the cool part. I had my old boss. And we've got to go. But my old boss, homeschooled his middle daughter or his youngest daughter. And, you know, I mean, he had the money and all that stuff, but I mean, it was so cool because they used to, they had a whole community, you know, because the argument is, well, my kid's going to not be socialized because they, you know, they don't interact with other kids and all this. Well, they used to have like big parties and stuff at his house because he had a huge property and he had, you know, landscaped it and everything else. So they used to have these parties all the time where all the homeschool families would come together and it gave them time to, you know, they were on Zoom calls or whatever with their friends. And then that was their time to play and have time to, you know, get to that was their socialization period.
In my experience, homeschooled kids are far more socialized than public school kids. And it's this idea that it's not in, okay, it's not socialization when you are around a group of kids your exact age in this forced situation.
Yeah.
It's about learning how to be with kids that are a few years older, kids that are a few years younger, adults, being able to look an adult in the eye and be able to have a conversation with an adult. Those are all the elements of socialization that homeschool kids have free access to. And most families are doing a lot of that stuff. You do not see that in public school at all.
No, like you said, they're dealing with, and a lot of times they're forced into situations with people that they don't really like.
Right.
You know, that are bullies or whatever versus if I don't like you, I don't have to hang out with you or I don't have to be around you.
Yes, at that exactly.
Point. So I love it. Well, Maura, if somebody is interested in learning a little bit more about what you're talking about, they're considering making this leap, maybe even making the leap to road schooling. What's the best place to get in contact with you?
So my website, constantly evolving, I have to say, is moiramills.com.
Okay, easy.
So I would say that that's the best place. And really, I am always on the other end of an email for anybody that has questions. I love talking about this all the time. So there are other things that I offer. You can run into it on the website, but really to just connect with me there. I also write a lot on my Substack, which is also, it's Substack/Moira Mills.
Okay, awesome. So. Substack.com/Moira.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. Yes.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on today. I could have talked to you for another hour, but it was just, it was a pleasant experience. And once again, I really thank you for what you're doing because like I said, I think we need to kind of unwind some of the thought processes around what an education really is. Because we put out a lot of people that theoretically are educated and are not, and there's not enough truly educated people in the world. So thank you for what you do every day.
Absolutely.
Folks, thank you for joining us. And please make sure you subscribe to the channel wherever you're listening or watching this. And we will see you back here the very next time.
Thank you for listening to the Freedom Nation Podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and all the major channels. Wherever you're listening, please subscribe to the channel and leave a rating and review. If you have friends and family that could benefit from their own Freedom Day, please share with them. Finally, join Freedom Nation by following us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.